This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Two words, everybody. Two little words. Sharknado and Sharknado 2. We will explain. Also, big banking and big tobacco. On the broadcast from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, the 7th of August. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. There is no shortage of global geopolitics to report on today. The Obama administration and airdrops of food and medicine to refugees in Iraq. Hamas saying it's not interested in extending the ceasefire in Gaza, which is set to expire tomorrow, and Russia hitting back against U.S. and European economic sanctions over Ukraine with some of its own. A ban on food and agricultural goods from the U.S., the EU, and a handful of other countries. Marketplace's Noel King has more now on how big a deal that might turn out to be.
This isn't the first Russian ban on U.S. food. Last February, Russia closed the door to U.S. beef and pork, citing a zero-tolerance policy to additives that are fed to U.S. cattle and hogs. Joe Sheely with the U.S. Meat Export Federation says the beef industry weathered the hit just fine.
Even with Russia out of the picture, our beef exports set a record last year of more than $6 billion.
The U.S. poultry industry still exports a lot to Russia. In the first half of this year, $129 million worth of chicken, mostly chicken legs. That's the dark meat that many Americans don't like to eat. But Jim Sumner, president of the USA Poultry and Egg Export Council, is also not that concerned.
If this would have happened 10 years ago or 15 years ago, it would have been catastrophic. But fortunately, our industry these days is far less dependent on Russia.
Russia has fallen to 7% of the U.S. poultry export market. Sumner says food exporters are used to dealing with changes.
Poultry has always been used as a political pawn. Russia, back in the late 90s, we've had chicken used for politics in China as well.
Last year, the U.S. exported a little over $1 billion worth of foodstuffs to Russia. The EU exported $16 billion. But it may be Russians who bear the brunt of the ban. Stephen Pfeiffer is with the Brookings Institution.
At a minimum, Russian consumers are going to see a large number of products disappear, and in replacing them, they're likely to see an increase in food prices.
He says the Russian government may be shooting itself in the hoof. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
The news of the financial world today comes courtesy of the initials B and A. Bank of America is said to be this close to an agreement with the Justice Department over its mortgage misdeeds in the run-up to the financial crisis. $17 billion or so is the figure that's being bandied about, which gets us, after similar deals with J.P. Morgan and Citigroup and a bunch of other banks, exactly where more than 5 years after the crash. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has that story from New York.
When bank settlements get announced, Charles Kenji Whitehead zeroes in on one thing.
If you read the statement of facts that get issued, your jaw drops at just how lax some of the internal controls were at these banks.
He's a Cornell law professor and former high-level banking attorney. Bankers made and sold dicey mortgage investments because their bank bonus structures rewarded them for it. And as a result, even when red flags went up,
no one slammed on the brakes. Have we actually done anything to address that problem? Not really.
Whitehead thinks recent changes on compensation and risk don't do enough. Banks say going further would damage their business, maybe even make it more expensive for regular people to bank. And as far as all those multi-billion dollar settlements, don't forget who really pays the tab.
We've seen only punishments of shareholders.
Jim Sinegal is Morningstar's lead bank analyst.
A lot of the executives, a lot of the people making money, making the most money in some cases, are not getting punished at all.
Then there's the problem of too big to fail, that taxpayers will get stuck bailing out banks. Dennis Kelleher runs the nonprofit Better Markets, a Wall Street critic. He takes a dim view of the bank's settlements, saying they should be bigger and more transparent. But at the same time, he's glad regulators told banks this week that their disaster planning doesn't cut it.
Rejecting these plans was a tremendous stride on behalf of the American people to get financial reform in place.
But of course, rejecting those plans means there still aren't acceptable ones. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders seemed geopolitically disinclined to buy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's been more than 15 years. 1998 is when it was, since what's called the Master Settlement went into effect. The agreement between the states and the tobacco industry that obliged cigarette companies to basically reimburse states for the costs of health care for smokers and to fund programs to get people to stop smoking. There's a new report out today from ProPublica that shows not only aren't those programs being funded, but in fact many states are now deeply in debt as a result of that settlement. Cesar Podkol wrote that piece. Cesar, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
I think probably we ought to start by laying out the terms of this settlement from 1998, right? That is whence all this money comes from.
Yeah, so in 1998, the attorneys general of 46 states, the District of Columbia, and five territories settled with Big Tobacco to pay them money in perpetuity, billions of dollars in perpetuity to reimburse the states for smoking-related health care costs.
And it was money that was going to come from cigarette sales, right?
Well, precisely right. It's directly tied to the volume of cigarettes that get sold.
Got it. And then you write, after this deal is done, the ink barely being dry, Wall Street comes a-knocking and says, hey, we've got an idea.
That's right. A couple of the attorneys general told us that immediately after a settlement was done, they started getting pitches from Wall Street bankers who came to the states and said, hey, you know, there's a risk that if people smoke less, then this revenue stream might decline. So why don't you shed that risk to investors who would buy bonds backed by the settlement monies so the money would flow to them. And then in return, you'd have this upfront cash.
And that part of it does make some sense, right? Investors take
Precisely.
The risk instead of the public, right?
Right, and that was the rationale behind the deals. Now, the plan was always that the states would be able to pay this back early. The projections that bankers used to sell the bonds were very optimistic at the time. They assumed that smoking would decline, but it would decline at a lesser pace than what we see today. What that means is there just simply isn't enough money available to repay this debt early.
I want to make sure I understand what's happening as a result of this securitization of the tobacco debt. What is basically happening in practice is that investors are getting this money stream from the settlement instead of the states and the people.
Precisely. Every year in April, a wire goes out from the tobacco companies to Citibank, and Citibank, wires the money out to states. If the state has done a tobacco deal to, securitize the proceeds, once the wire comes in, the state doesn't get to keep that cash. It doesn't go into the general fund. It skips the general fund, and obviously it will then go to the investors.
The place where a lot of states are getting into trouble or have gotten into trouble are these things called capital appreciation bonds. What are they?
A capital appreciation bond is basically a type of borrowing where instead of paying, interest and principal down over the life of the bond, what you're doing is you're just letting that interest accrue and get added onto the principal and the accrued amount and sort of build and build and snowball until, not 30 years, but in many times we found these bonds had the term lives of 40, 50, sometimes even more than 50 years, where the interest would grow into, many billions of dollars.
You make special mention of the state of Ohio, whose treasurer back then was Richard Cordray, now the guy running the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, right? They borrowed, $319 million in these capital appreciation bonds, and they will owe at maturity in 2047 $6.6 billion, right? So
2047 and 2050, there's right. two different maturities. But if you added it all up, it's 319.
Right. The middle of the century will be bad news for the state of Ohio.
Well, like most of the states that did this, Ohio created a separate authority to sell these bonds, meaning that these debts would be only the sole obligation of the authority and not of the state of Ohio. However, many analysts we talked to said it would be natural for bondholders to come knocking on the state's doors and say, hey, you sold us this product that's defaulted. You know, we're buyers of your other debt. Can you help us out? So that conversation is likely to happen.
It's pretty easy to see who the losers are, right, in the securitization of this tobacco debt. I'm going to go way out on a limb here and guess that Wall Street is the winner.
Oh, by far, absolutely the biggest winners. Just for, you know, the fees that banks earned alone, it was about $400 million. And then if you add in the money that the consultants and then the lawyers, you know, earned on top of that, you get well over $500 million they've collected so far in doing these deals, many of which now are going to be heading into default, meaning nonpayment. And as a result, you know, we already see bankers pitching their services to states, you know, as I just mentioned, to help fix the situation.
That's beautiful, man.
Yeah. And then once they fix the situation, of course, they get even more money. So the fees are going to keep coming into Wall Street.
There is a link to this piece on our website, marketplace.org, of course. Cesar Podgol writes on finance for ProPublica. Cesar, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
Coming up.
No. We like mockbusters. We're really thrilled, actually, that there's a whole genre kind of dedicated to what we do.
What the producers of Sharknado are really like. But first, let's do the numbers. All righty, here we are on a Thursday in August. The major indices all dropped about 0.5% today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average off 75 points, settled at 16,368. The NASDAQ fell 20 points, down to 43.34, neatly palindromic there. The S&P 500 took off 10 points, wrapped at 1909. All right, so when does a Facebook post move markets? How about when it comes from Netflix CEO Reed Hastings announcing that his company beat out HBO for subscriber revenue? Netflix reeled in 4.5%. Today, the security software company Symantec powered up 1% on strong quarterly profits. JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Morgan Stanley all gave back more than 0.5%. Yesterday, 21st Century Fox soared after dropping its Time Warner takeover bid. Today, it sashayed up the red carpet another 5%, driven by ticket sales from Rio 2 and X-Men, among others. Time Warner, by the by, dropped another 3%. Today, bond prices rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.41%. That is, should you be curious, and I know you are, its lowest level of this year. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on wholesale inventories and sales for June. The Labor Department issues its preliminary productivity and cost report for the second quarter. And actor Richard Anderson turns 88. He portrayed Oscar Goldman, the boss of TV's bionic icon Steve Austin and Jamie Summers. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Back in June, the EPA released something called the Clean Power Plan. We told you about it at the time. Its proposal for regulating carbon emissions from existing power plants. That is, obviously, greenhouse gases. Included in that plan were targets for each state to hit in carbon emissions. For instance, Texas. The EPA's proposal created some challenges for the second biggest and very energy-hungry state. But as always, with challenges do come opportunities, as Marketplace's Dan Weissman explains.
Here's the sound of the biggest challenge for Texas in meeting its emissions goals. That's a home air conditioner in Austin, kicking in on a summer afternoon. Texas summers are murder without AC, and the state's grid has to be ready for demand to spike quickly on a hot day. And here's the sound of eight technicians marshaling the gigawatts it takes to run all those air conditioners. Ready? That's the silence in the control room at the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, ERCOT for short. Dan Woodfin is ERCOT's operations director.
ERCOT covers about 85% of the entire state of Texas. Our grid serves about 24 million people.
Woodfin oversees a huge room near Austin, lit mainly by computer monitors, 10 or so on each desk, plus the big board, 50 feet wide, with maps, charts, weather projections, all shifting in real time. Looks a little like something out of the TV show 24, but a lot quieter.
It's not as crazy, if you will, as what you would typically see on an episode of 24.
ERCOT sends signals to turn different power sources on and off, coal, gas, wind, and nuclear, at just the right time for everybody's AC to keep running. Each source costs a different amount to run and takes a different amount of time to turn on and off. Near Houston, Steve Hedge watches ERCOT's signals at a giant power plant he manages for NRG Energy. The plant has three different types of generators.
The coal units are a low-cost generation. They run all the time, 24 hours a day.
Next come some big gas generators.
Gas is a lot more expensive fuel than coal right now, so it costs more to make that power. Those units start and stop every day during the summertime.
But those units don't start on a dime, 3 hours minimum. So what if the temperature suddenly spikes? That's where another kind of gas generator comes in, a peaker.
This unit can respond to those short peaks, start real quick, provide the power, and then shut off.
It's less efficient and more expensive to run, but it comes in handy on hot days. So Steve Hedge, his counterparts at other plants, and ERCOT are all working with two variables, cost and timing. EPA's Clean Power Plan introduces a third, carbon emissions. The coal generators are cheap to run because coal is cheap, but they emit more carbon dioxide. One way or another, probably by some switching from coal to less cheap gas, reducing emissions will raise electricity prices. Probably
about $1 billion a year.
That's John Larson. He's an analyst with the Rhodium Group, which issued a study on the Clean Power Plan in July. He says that billion-dollar bill spread across Texas and three next-door states comes with a big upside for the region.
Anywhere from $2 or $3 billion a year on average up to as high as 16 or 17.
From pumping natural gas. That's because Texas isn't the only state that will have to do some switching from coal to gas.
That increases the demand for natural gas, so parts of the country that produce natural gas do quite well. And in fact, Texas is one of the largest gas-producing states in the country.
And there's your upside. Then there's a construction project behind one of Steve Hedge's coal generators, a system to capture the carbon dioxide.
We're going to take that CO2 and we're going to put it in a pipeline and inject it into an oil field south of the plant.
The project, called Petranova, combines two things. First is a step happening here, carbon capture. It's technology the EPA would like to see used more, but it's expensive. The second part pays the bill by putting that carbon to lucrative use in the oil field. Pump carbon into a played-out oil field, and it'll pump out more oil. Arun Benskota is president of Petranova, a subsidiary of NRG. He says the oil field right now produces about 500 barrels a day. Add carbon, and
we'll be producing an average of 15,000 barrels a day.
30 times as much. Benskota hopes to repeat the process elsewhere. He says there are lots of Texas oil fields where carbon dioxide could help. To hit them all,
you need approximately 100 projects of the type we're doing right now. The potential is huge and the opportunity is huge.
But not just anywhere. Kentucky has lots of carbon dioxide, but not so many oil fields. Again, advantage, Texas. I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
If you spend almost any time online or on social media or, I don't know, breathing, chances are that last week you heard a little something about a movie sequel that was, I guess, highly anticipated would be the phrase. If you didn't hear about it, here's a hint. Twisters and Great Whites, the low-budget but spectacularly successful films Sharknado and now Sharknado 2 have taken the entertainment world by storm, if you'll pardon the pun, in part because they were produced with just a fraction of the budget of standard Hollywood blockbusters and still got plenty of eyeballs. The studio responsible for the glory that is the Sharknados is called The Asylum. It's right over in Burbank, so of course we had to go. The head of production and one of the founders is a guy named David Latt, who, when I met him at the door the other day, was for some reason wearing rollerblades.
It's the way I get around. Right. You know, we had a lot of concrete here, and I said, I need to put on skates.
I will follow you at a human pace.
Okay, great. And I'll skate slowly. All
right. There you go.
So, kind of getting the lay of the land of what the asylum is?
Tell us where we are.
All right, so the asylum is a fully functional studio. We do everything from soup to nuts, come up with the ideas, release the films. We have a worldwide distribution center. We are a studio. We're everything without the theme park.
Yeah.
So,
but the thing about you, well, there are many things about you guys, which is why we're here. One of them is you do it crazy fast.
We do crazy fast. That's why the skates. So
touché.
Basically, we're producing about 2 to 3 films every month.
That's insane.
We do everything in-house because we're films made to order. So my partners are making deals with their buyers, and they're telling them exactly what they want, and then we go and pretty much make the film to order exactly what they need. So
which seems to make a whole lot of sense, right?
We've never lost money.
Say that again.
We have never lost money.
That's
amazing. And we don't do porn. So it's crazy.
Tell me how you do that. They come to you and they say, oh, I don't know, just for argument's sake, we want to make a movie called Sharknado.
Right.
And you say...
First, I try not to judge.
You don't judge, because look at the stuff that's on the walls. Hercules, Sharknado, Blood Lake. No,
it's
come
just
on.
Lampreys.
Atlantic Rim? Pacific Rim was a good film. I saw that and I liked it.
It was good. Well, then you'll enjoy this
one.
Now?
No.
Yeah,
all right.
Not really.
Well, so this actually brings up a question I wanted to ask you. You guys prefer the phrase tie-ins instead of
mockbusters. No. We like mockbusters. We're good.
All right. Well,
we're really thrilled, actually, that there's a whole genre kind of dedicated to what we do.
And so you guys take, you know, well-known films and you schedule your releases and you title them close to the original article.
I mean, what we do on the mockbuster front is something the studios do. They just call it drafting. You know, it's like having Volcano and Dante speak at the same time. When you find out that someone's making a film about transforming robots, the appetite out there in the world, so the theory goes, is that people want more about transforming robots.
Right.
So we're going to go and create a film that kind of takes advantage of the awareness of transforming robots.
Remind me, it was Transmorphers? Was that
yes.
it?
Yes.
Okay.
Taste this, tinhead.
Oh, man, wait, what is that?
These are sharks from a film called Two-Headed Shark Attack.
Oh.
We're about ready to do Three-Headed Shark Attack.
You should know the last scary movie I saw, no kidding, was Jaws. And I was 12.
That's why it shaped you.
I am scarred and wounded.
This is why you do what you do and you don't do what we do.
I couldn't, honestly.
You know, if I saw, like, Wall Street, you know, back then, it scarred me. I would be doing, you know. So I get it.
Let's go kill some sharks!
This is all about production, audition, so castings makeup, here, audition story rooms, line producer rooms.
Editing, right? Is that what that was?
And our studio space.
No, wait, look, this is an airplane.
It's an airplane.
Wow. And, so this is how they do it.
Here's the economics of this.
Yes.
There are only two studios in Los Angeles that have an airplane set. They are $6,000 a day.
That's insane.
We use this a lot. And so we were coming up with a film called Airplane versus Volcano.
This is awesome.
And we needed it for 3 weeks. So we bought this for about $10,000. Now we have this. We're like now studio number 3 that has a plane set. And we shot this for Sharknado 2. There's an opening segment with...
Don't spoil it.
They're sharks. They're scary. No one wants to get eaten. But I've been eaten. And I'm here to tell you, it takes a lot more than that to bring a good man down.
Yeah.
Once your movies are made and they're out there and they're on Sci-Fi or wherever they're going to go, and you guys have the cash in your pocket. This is, I guess, a little bit of a pejorative question, but do you care if anybody watches it?
It's a good question. I'm so focused on the films that I'm making that I don't really focus on that question.
All right, well, what about your development partners?
I mean, do they? I'll tell you, I was really surprised that people knew who we were a few years ago. After Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus, I just assumed that no one was watching our movies, and yet now I see people with tattoos, on themselves with our movies on there. So it's one of those things. I don't understand the fan base and don't understand who likes it and who doesn't.
You're putting a tattoo of my movie on your skin? Are you kidding me?
It's bizarre.
In 97, you guys start this studio. Did you think that it was going to last?
I still don't think it's going to last. I know how lucky I am and that we are to last as long as we have in this business. We don't have outside investors. We are a cash flow company.
Wow.
So the reason why we make so many movies is because we need to keep this dog and pony show up and running, because the film we make today is the film that's going to fund the film 5 months from now.
If the major studios called, and this is not a fair question to ask you on the record, but I will anyway.
Yes, I will sell. I'll sell. Wait,
there
sorry.
You go.
It did.
Right?
Okay.
I mean, come on.
I think when we started the company and we started outputting so many, we said, okay, at 100 films, we're going to sell the company.
Yeah.
And, here we are past 200, and there's some really exciting things going on. I mean, I think we're always going to be entertaining ideas, empire building from an outside company or from within, and to see where this this craziness takes us.
Holy shark.
We spoke to David Latt's partners at the asylum while we were out there. Equally entertaining gentlemen, I should say. We videotaped the whole thing. You can check it out at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, it's a quickie because we're a little bit short on time. Somebody at the Washington Post, though, clearly has too much time on their hands, because after President Obama was more than an hour late to a news conference after the Africa summit yesterday, they went to official White House records and added up how late the president has been all year, a cumulative total of presidential tardiness, if you will. Here's the number. 2,121 minutes late has the president been, 35 hours, 21 minutes since January the 1st of this year, which, okay. Also, this about that monkey selfie I told you about yesterday, the one the guy who owned the camera the monkey used to take the picture wants Wikipedia to take down, but Wikipedia doesn't want to take down. Wikipedia wants to make sure that everybody knows it never said the monkey owns the copyright, just that the human being whose camera it was definitely doesn't own it. And with that, we are out of here. The Dow off 75 points today, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ down 20 points, also 0.5%. The S&P 500 took off 10 points, yes, also 0.5%. John Buckley, Kim Bowie, John Haas, Patty Hearst, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.